Welcome. This is Cascade Church Portland's podcast. We exist to invite all people to join us as we follow Jesus together in bringing heaven to earth.
Good morning. My name is Kurt. I'm a pastor here at Cascade, and I am looking forward to the message today. I hope you are a little bit. We're going to have some fun. It is my voice changed, so that's the proof it's going to be some fun. And talking about the message today, I grew up like way out in the country. There wasn't anything around for a long time. And how many of you grew up in a small town? Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a lot. Or all small town people have big hands and it distracts me from me. All right, so this is, I'm interested. How many of you grew up in a town of 5,000 or less? Okay. How many grew up in a town of 2,500 or less? How many grew up in a town of 1,000 or less? How many of you grew up in a town of 500 or less? Anyone? Okay, good. All right. Yeah, that's good. Thank you. Yeah, and I saw some hands pop up after 1,000. I don't know if we'll do a refresher on numbers afterwards, but it was like we're going down. That's a new hand. How did that get there? Yeah, that's right. So I grew up in such a small town that when people ask me, I start three towns outside of my town as one that might be, like you might have some idea, and then we keep on getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And like it's fun for me. It's like a little adventure when people are like, oh no, I know that. I grew up, I'm like, oh, well then let's go next level right now. We actually have a picture. It's on the internet. This is the Farmington, California General Store, the Farmington General Store, in the town that I grew up of 180. I grew up in a town of 180. And this is the fun thing about the Farmington General Store. It's been there forever. I watched many a parade on the, what is that? What's this called? I blanked on it. Veranda? Ooh. Oh. It feels way too fancy for Farmington, California. Porch, that's what we called it, yep. Maybe in Portland you have verandas. We got porches in Farmington. And here's the fun thing about Farmington, California. It may come as a shock to you. There is no mayor of Farmington, California, a population 180. But my dad and my uncle, because I would say half of the 180 have the last name Croon, in the city of Farmington, they would sit right there in that window in between the beer posters, and they would drink coffee every Saturday morning. And they would come, and they called themselves the mayors of Farmington. There was my dad, my uncle, our neighbor Tom, and there was like one other guy. Sorry if you're listening. I don't remember your name. But they would come and they would have coffee and they would catch up on all the agricultural news, the stuff in the, and my favorite thing they would do is as they would talk, it was hotter in there than it was outside. In the condensation on the window, this right here, that just looks like a road, but it's actually Highway 4 in California, and a lot of people use it to go to Yosemite. So they'll go driving past there and the cops will be out there and they'll pull people for blowing that stop sign because people are like, seriously, 180, there's no reason to stop here. We just keep right on going. And they would make little marks in the condensation of the window of all the cars that got pulled over. The highest I ever got was 8 on one Saturday morning, which is a lot of fun. I remember going as a kid with my dad to the Farmington General Store and listening to them talk. And it was the water cooler for this small town. That's where you heard about everything. All the goods were delivered at the Farmington General Store. And if you've ever been in any kind of community, any kind of workspace, you have these spaces, these moments. There's this kind of power in the gossip, in the updates of the town. Gossip is so intoxicating because all of us want to belong somewhere. And nothing makes us feel like we belong more than being up on the social to-dos of whatever group we're a part of. Like if you go to Thanksgiving dinner and someone starts talking about, yeah, you know, Uncle Tom got gout. And you're like, Uncle Tom got gout? I had no idea. There's a little spark in the people that knew that Uncle Tom had gout. They're like, I know about the gout. Months now, we've had this information. It's this information that we have that makes us feel like we are central, we are vital, we have a role within this place. And we have these gathering spots where these things are spoken. They're kind of the centers of our home life, of our work life, of the places where we go and work. You probably had these spots in school. In the school I went to, there was this one particular hallway, and that's where you hung out to find out all the good stuff. And the story that we're looking at today, as we do this our last week in the book of Isaiah, this is about those places. This is about the water cooler. This is about the Farmington General Store. This is the place where the conversations happen. And what we're going to look at this morning is we're going to look at the taunting voices. So this is like the meeting spot, the spot where it comes, but there's a very particular taunt that comes from this place. And so we're going to look at who are the taunting voices in your life. Who are the people that have these kind of messages of taunt, of a use of power that they have over you? And as important, what are the taunting voices that you have internally? What are the taunts you keep on bringing upon yourself? About who you are, about what you do, about what your identity is. So if you brought your Bible with you, we are going to be looking at Isaiah 36. We're going to start Isaiah 36, 1. To set the scene, because we've been going through this book for a while, Isaiah, a book in the Old Testament, this is 700-800 years before the time of Jesus. This is the northern kingdom of the Israelites. If that doesn't mean anything to you, it's fine. It's okay if it does. Hooray. But it's this nation that is basically, it's small, but it still has a king, King Hezekiah. And they are in between a number of different nations and world powers. So we talked about Assyria, we've talked about Egypt, and they're trying to figure out who do we align with. And the prophet Isaiah is speaking to the Israelite people and saying, what are you doing? Did you know that every great ruler of the world, every great kingdom of the world has failed? Every great ruler has died. And so there's this idea where we can find the right one. We can unlock the right code. And what the prophet is saying is this is a fool's errand. It doesn't make any sense. You're just trying to align yourself with this power, but there's not real power there. And so what we get to is we have a bunch of woes. We have a bunch of like, it's all going to be terrible. People are going to be destroyed. There's a lot of that. It's been a real page turner, real uplifter here in Cascade. But what we want to look at today is a story. It's a narrative of what happens when some of these woes, some of these tales comes into an actual story at a place a lot like the Farmington General Store. So Isaiah 36, starting in verse 1, we're going to go through a big chunk of scripture. So jump on in. In the 14th year of King Hezekiah's reign, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, attacked all of the fortified cities of Judah and captured them. Then the king of Assyria sent his field commander with a large army from Lachish to King Hezekiah at Jerusalem. When the commander stopped at the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to the launderer's field, Eliakim, son of Hilkiah, the palace administrator, Shebna, the secretary, and Joah, son of Asaph, the recorder, went out to him. That was fun. By the way, if you ever read the Bible and you're like, I don't know how to pronounce those names, no one does. So just have fun, you know? Just give it a go. If we could go back for a second, this is what's important. When it talks about they conquered all the cities of Judah, Judah is the nation. It's the northern kingdom. But Jerusalem is the center, the capital city of the whole area. So they've been picking off all these outside cities and conquering them, and they're getting more and more to the capital city. So if you think of this, you're in, I know Portland's not the capital of Oregon, but I mean, it kind of is. So imagine that you're in Portland, Oregon, and there's this conquering force, and like they picked off Corvallis, they picked off Eugene, they picked off Salem, like they're moving and working their way here. And so there's this feeling of this impending doom. And so, and once you are this the rulers of Assyria and you've been picking off city after city, you're like, you have no support. You have no one that can come to your aid. You're just the last domino that needs to fall. So they're not walking in trying to barter peace. They're walking in with high confidence, this field commander that's sent with the military. So we're going to continue on in verse 4. This is what the great king, the king of Assyria, says. On what are you basing this confidence of yours? You say you have counsel and might for war, but you speak only empty words. On whom are you depending that you rebel against me? Look, I know you're depending on Egypt, that splintered reed of a staff, which pierces the hand of anyone who leans on it. Such is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who depend on him. Oh, sick burns. So he's coming in and he's saying, we have this military force. You're depending on Egypt. And it's this beautiful imagery, which comes up again in scripture. It's a big reason why, if you read the Bible on your own time, don't ignore the Old Testament. They use these themes that are started in the Old Testament again in the New Testament. It fleshes out so much of the story. It's like a whole Bible for a reason, all right? And he says it's this staff that you would lean on to support yourself. When you're weak, you would lean on it. It's a splintered reed. It's going to hurt you to lean on. You're depending on Egypt, but there's no strength there. There's no security, and it's going to hurt you more than it's worth. And think of this thing, that if you are there, and we're going to talk about, we have the three kind of representatives of King Hezekiah who's there. There's a part of them where they feel like, yeah, they're big and scary, but little do they know the card I got up my sleeve, like, we're in cahoots with Egypt. And he's like, no, I know about the whole Egypt thing. Come on. You think that's scary? So there's already kind of setting in this undercutting their confidence, undercutting their ability and their belief in themselves. Continuing on in verse 7. Come now, make a bargain with my master, the king of Assyria. I will give you 2,000 horses if you can put riders on them. Let's just stop for a second, because this is great. He's like, hey, we have our military, and we come to destroy you. How about this? I'll give you 2,000 horses. You don't have a cavalry. I'll just spot you like a 14-point lead in this football game, all right? We'll just give you 2,000 horses, although, let's be honest, you probably don't have people that can even ride them. Oh, man! Okay, continuing on. How then can you repulse one officer of the least of my master's officials, even though you are depending on Egypt for chariots and horsemen? Furthermore, I have come to attack and destroy this land without the Lord. The Lord himself told me to march against this country and destroy it. Oh, hello. So he's saying first, why would you depend on Egypt? And now he's saying, oh, I bet you're thinking that the Lord is the one that's going to take care of you and protect you. Guess what? God talks to me too, and he told me to come and destroy you. Another way where he's using, what are the things that you depend on? What do you rely on? The military force of others? Yeah, we got that taken care of. Your own ability to scheme and figure things out, which kind of ties to that. Yeah, we got that figured out. Is it your faith? Is it your religion? Yeah, God talks to me too, and he said, we're going to wipe you out. Continuing on in verse 11. Then Eliakim and Shebna and Joah said to the field commander, please speak to your servants in Aramaic, since we understand it. Don't speak to us in Hebrew in the hearing of the people on the wall. It's about to get real. But the commander replied, was it only to your master and to your and you that my master sent me to say these things, and not to the people sitting on the wall, who, like you, will have to eat their own excrement and drink their own urine? Whew. Field commander's coming in hot. Here's what we have. They are doing this at the aqueduct. This is the Farmington General Store. So all the people are there watching. This is theater. He's coming not just to have a private conversation, he's having it with everyone. And the Israelite people, we have historical evidence that say that their elite, those are kind of trained to work. So all of these people, because they knew that Assyria was so important and they had so many people that were moving with trade and commerce and government, only those who had been raised in kind of the leadership of Israel, they were trained to speak Aramaic. So what they're saying, which is the Assyrian language, hey, but the field commander was speaking to them in Hebrew in their language, and they're like, hey, cool it with the Hebrew. Let's go to Aramaic. Let's just talk, us. The three of us and you. And he's saying, oh, no. When I utterly destroy you, which we all agree is going to happen, these people here on the walls are going to be suffering too. And when you hear these things about eating your own excrement, drinking your own urine, this is the result of sieges that would happen. They would block off all their access to food and water, and in the most dire days at the end of it, that's what it would come to. So he's already speaking to, we all know where this is going. We all know how powerful we are. This is the most taunting voice I think I've ever read or seen in the Bible. I can't think of many other examples that comes in with such bravado, such power, such certainty that he is right and he has the power and he knows how this thing is going to go out. The voice of the field commander is centered on one thing, and that's fear. He is exploiting all of the fears of the people. You don't have a chance. And again, all the things, you're relying on Egypt, not going to work. You're relying on your God, not going to work. And to these leaders, you're relying on your specialized knowledge of us and who we are as the Assyrians, not going to work. I speak Hebrew here. And so what I want us to reflect on for a second is, where do we see and hear these voices in our own lives? See, one of the points of going back and reading the Bible, the entirety of the Bible is a story about humanity and God, humanity with one another and God. And so when we read it and uncover it, if we just get very specific about what it means, then the only way we can understand this chapter is when you or someone you know is in some sort of military battle and the aggressor is coming in very forcefully. But when we zoom out, we say, no, this is a much bigger theme that we see in how humanity engages with one another and how humanity engages with God. The larger theme here is the voice of taunting, the voice of certainty, the voice that says to it, you're going to lose. You're going to fail. I know it's a little taboo because we're not quite to Christmas yet, but it reminds me of a Christmas story. You know that voice? You're going to shoot your eye out. Over and over and over. You're like, no, there's this thing I'm going to, there's this thing I'm working. I think I can. No, you're going to shoot your eye out from his parents, from his teacher, from Santa Claus himself. You're going to shoot your eye out. And we have these voices in our lives. There are people, maybe within your own family, maybe people that will sit around the Thanksgiving table that have said to you, you're going to fail. It's not going to work out. That relationship isn't going to work out. You're going to school for what? Well, why don't you find a career that pays something? Or why don't you find a career that you can be successful at? Or maybe can pay some bills. We have all kinds of people in our lives who step in and they think that they're helping, but what they're telling us is you can't do it, you won't do it, and they speak with absolute certainty. And some of us know this voice. Some of us can see that face. Here's the one that for me personally, and maybe not for you, that I'm interested in this morning. I have been fortunate enough in my life, I don't have a lot of these voices externally. And if I have, I don't listen to them anymore. But this taunting voice internally, oh man, does it fire up with regularity? A voice that's in me is saying, you're trying what? You think people are going to listen to you on a Sunday morning? Why would they do that? You're gonna be the pastor of a church that's starting new. There hasn't been a place before. Why would you do that? I have this voice when I go and meet with people, and I'm like, this person is so successful in this thing and that thing. Why would they even want to have coffee or have lunch? When I go to parent my child, I'm like, how much therapy am I buying for my child in the future right now? How much am I doing this thing that's going to screw them up? Is it going to mess this thing up? Which, by the way, as an aside, literally just last night, we have our dogs down in like this little area, and our dog kept on getting into the house. Like, it kept on happening. So I sat our boys down. I'm like, boys, you cannot let Frank, the wiener dog, out. Like, he will wreak havoc. If you go into the playroom, just close the gate behind you. Got you, Dad. 2 minutes later, Frank's just trotting through the house like he owns the place. I'm like, boys, you can't let Frank out of the playroom. He wreaks havoc. We got it? Yes. 1 minute later, Frank is just trotting through the house. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. We have one more, like the serious face. I'm on my knees delivering this message eye to eye. Shoo Frank back in there. 30 seconds later, just to mess with me, Frank is trotting through the house, and I let on a full name yell. Palmer, Ronald Groon. How is Frank out again? Put him back in there. Palmer is in tears and runs to his room. 20 seconds later. And I realize that Frank has found out he can nose out the gate himself. And he has by himself been sneaking into our house over and over again. And maybe you can see this through the eyes of my child. This is why I tell this story. I felt awful. Like the voices came just rushing in. Like, what are you, monster? What were you doing? You were yelling at a four-year-old because the dog was walking through the house. Does this seem rational or normal? And when I went into Palmer's room and I opened the door, I said, buddy, I have to talk with you. You know what he said? I know, Dad, I know I messed up. And he hadn't at all. I said, no, I messed up, buddy. Frank got himself out alone. The reason why I tell that story is there's these moments where the external voices become internal. And the voices have told you, you screwed up enough, whether it's true or not, it's the voice that you believe. It's the voice that you start believing. Why do we talk about this in church? This is not how God has created you to be. This isn't the life that God made you for. God wasn't like, I'm going to create some people, and then we're just going to beat out of them, you know, through other voices telling them their insignificance. We're going to beat out this kind of will and like desire to live. Like, we're going to get them deep in this pain, and that's when they're going to start going to church. Like, that's when it's going to pay off. God has created us for freedom. God has created us to see ourselves as being creations of a loving God. So when we feel and hear these voices, when we internalize, when we hear ourselves saying something to ourselves about our failure, about our weakness, we can be sure that is a voice. We can also be sure that is not the voice of God. That is not the voice of God. So I want to look at these two voices to say, what are some of the aims of them before we continue on in the story? The first is looking at that external voices, internal and external voices of taunting, of telling us how it's going to go down and how we're going to fail. External voices are leading us towards fear-based dependence. Fear-based dependence. Here's what I mean. Think of the field commander. He's telling them all the way that they're not going to fail. And he isn't saying this so that you're going to feel awful about yourself. And you know what? That makes me feel a little better about myself. No, there's very much an aim here. If you feel awful enough about yourself, if you're certain enough of your lack of worth and ability, then suddenly my words become more powerful. The people in your life that tell you what you can't do are trying to take over that voice. And I would say, whether knowingly or not, they're trying to take over the voice of God in our lives. A God who has this voice of love and calling us fully into who we are, they're trying to take the place of God and say, no, you're not good, you're not capable, you can't do this, so you should listen to me. You can't depend on Egypt. You can't depend on your God. You can't depend on your inside knowledge of our culture and who we are because I speak your language. So you know what you need to depend on? Me. Can't you hear it? The field commander is saying, look, I'm the only friend you have. And if you would just decide to go through this process through me, we can take care of you. We can make sure that you can be okay. So when we hear these voices of people internally, know where it's going. Fear-based dependence. And this is not how we were created to live. This isn't who we were created to be. Secondly, when we have these voices coming from inside the house, when we have these internal voices, they're moving us towards fear-based, or we're moving ourselves towards fear-based justification. Here's what I mean by this. If we believe enough on who we're not, if we believe enough on our failures, if we say, I can't do these things, then there are certain behaviors, there are certain things that we can justify. Now, sometimes this can be things about like addictions. This can be things like escapism. This can be things that are bad and harmful. But usually what it results in is the internal voice of fear, of taunting, leads us to not show up to our own lives. It leads us to not try. It leads us to not risk. And now we're justified in not trying because we've convinced ourselves it's probably going to fail anyway. This isn't going anywhere. And this is why this is so important. If God created you, and you are all unique individuals, you have things you're not good at, absolutely, but that also means you have things that you are incredibly good at, that you do with ease, that other people are like, that's amazing, how'd you do that? And you're like, it's not that big of a deal. That's because God created that, put that within you, and that's what you were made for. So actually, it's not no big deal. It's a very big deal that you can do that thing. And yet, when we believe the voice internally that says it's not worth it, it's not going to work out, we tend to not show up to our own lives. We tend to not show up into the things that we can do excellently because we're sure that it's going to fail. And now we're justified in that because we're believing the voice that it's not going to work out anyway. It's not going to work out anyway. Again, this is not what God created us for. And one of the ways we know it within the context of Isaiah is the voice of Isaiah, the prophet, is calling the Israelite people to repentance because it's saying there's an identity you have as a nation that you're not living into. There's a way you're supposed to be a blessing for the entirety of the world that you're not living into because you bought the voice of fear internally from inside yourselves that we have no power, and externally from these other world powers that are like, we're just going to conquer you anyway. And when you buy into those voices, you stop living into what you were created to be. The nation of Israel is supposed to be a blessing to the whole world, the means by which God's love, God's peace, God's grace is known to the entirety of the world. And they stopped being that because they bought into these taunting voices internally and externally. There's so much more than that. So, what do we do? How do we respond? The good news is that in this particular story, King Hezekiah, who's the king of Israel, he gets this message back, and in his response, I think we see some really practical and helpful next steps for us. So we're going to jump forward to Isaiah 37, the next chapter. We're going to look at 14 through 20. Hezekiah received the letter from the messengers and read it. Then he went up to the temple of the Lord and spread it out before the Lord. And Hezekiah prayed to the Lord, Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, enthroned between the cherubim, you alone are God over all the kingdoms of the earth. You've made heaven and earth. Give ear, Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, Lord, and see. Listen to all the words of Sennacherib has sent to ridicule the living God. Continuing on in verse 18, he says, it is true, Lord, that the Assyrians have laid waste to all these peoples and their lands. They have thrown their gods into the fire and destroyed them. For they were not gods, but only wood and stone fashioned by human hands. Now, Lord our God, deliver us from his hand, so that all the kingdoms on earth may know that you, Lord, are the only God. So here's what I love. He said, you guys are totally going to lose. You're depending on Egypt. God probably sent me to destroy you. And it's going to end terribly for you. And Hezekiah, think for a second what it would be like to be Hezekiah. You have the fate of all the people in the land that is resting on your shoulders. The decision you make and how you navigate this can mean thousands of people are killed or thousands of people are spared. And you have this identity thing. Like, it's not just survival, where most of us in this place, we go to decisions of survival, but you also have, like, who is God and how does God show up in this? What I love is Hezekiah goes to God. And I love that he actually lays out the messages. He lays them out before God and, like, this is what's being said against us. All right, and here's the thing I want you to catch. It's my favorite part of it. Do you notice the thing that he says? It's true. They're really super powerful. They've destroyed many, many of the nations around me. When we hear these voices of taunting, they're usually not, or the ones that hurt the most aren't completely unfounded. There's a thread of truth there. And that's why it stings. That's why it hurts. You've never done anything successful in your life. Not true, but there are failures within your story. And so that's the reason why that criticism stings. That's why that taunt stings, because there's a thread of truth there. And usually we want to run from that thread of truth because we think if I buy into that thread of truth, it makes the whole thing true. If I take any part of the thing that I'm saying to myself or that the voices outside of me are saying to me is true, it's all true. And then I don't do anything. And then I feel awful about myself and who I've been created to be. But Hezekiah doesn't say, hey, it's not true. We're just going to ignore this thing. And you know, Assyria isn't that strong. We can get it figured out. No. God, you know, they're incredibly strong. They destroyed a lot of nations. And yet, there's something else that's true here that hasn't been introduced to this. And God, you are the God of all. God, you see the whole picture. God, this is what I love. We, as human beings, when we're under threat, we just react and we respond. It's how we're wired. It's like our survival. When we feel threatened, we just respond. If you've ever had an argument with a loved one and you've said something, you're like, where did that come from? That was the voice of survival coming out of you. You said something pretty awful to create the space you felt like you needed to be safe. And yet, God exists outside of that. God never goes into fight or flight. Are you with me? God never goes into fight or flight. So when we're in those places, we can trust our judgment. We can rely on how we think. Or we can say, no, there's something else. There's another perspective that doesn't fall into these traps that either runs or starts a fight. God, what are you calling me to do? God, who are you calling me to be? How are you calling me to show up in this? So here's the opportunity for us. If we think again of these taunting voices that we hear externally or the ones that we hear internally, how do we acknowledge our fear and remind ourselves of the truth? Yep, this thing is true. I've had failed relationships in my past. Yep, this thing's true. I've been fired from other jobs. I picked organizations to work for. It hasn't worked out. Yep, that thing's true. I've changed my major 3 times. Yep. Yeah, I took this test to move into this thing and I failed. Yeah, that's true. And then how do we remind ourselves of the better truth? And yet, I have been created by God and there is a space for me. There is a role for me. There is a path for me in this world that is good. And when I walk it, I will feel the God who made me. I will feel and experience the God who created me and called me to that path and has moved me on. If you just try and fast forward to, nope, God, you're the God of all, but you never acknowledge the fear, it's going to ring hollow. It's never going to land. If we just respond to our fear with never acknowledging it and just saying, but God, you're greater. God, you're bigger than all this. God, you can take over the whole thing. It's coming out of a different place. And fear-based praise is not something that God's particularly interested in because it doesn't move us. It doesn't land us in a place that is grounded and beautiful and ready to move forward. There's a way in the different experiences I've had in the church where fear avoidance is at the heartbeat of the church. And we use God not to say, well, if God is with me, then I can acknowledge all of the fears around me and say, yeah, those things are true and that's okay. I use this idea that there's a God who's all powerful to ignore all of the fears I have and like, just keep moving, just keep praising. It's going to get better. It's going to get better. No. This is the transformative nature of having the God of the universe on our side. We can face our fears. We can sit in the room with them and say, I see you. It's okay. You don't have power over me. Your past failures don't make you a failure. The things that haven't gone right in the past don't create your identity. It's a beautiful thing about the nature of God. And so some of us in the room today, as we have internal or external voices, some of us need to face a fear we've been running from for a long time. And we need to face that fear knowing that God is with us. Some of us have been facing all of our fears, but we haven't stepped into a truth that God is with us in that, that God can overcome those fears. Just facing your fears creates a person who's transfixed by fear. It doesn't create a person who is free. It's an important two-step process. We face our fears and then we remind ourselves of the truth. So here's how I want to end this morning. I'm going to invite you to face a fear about yourself, about your identity. We're going to have a time of prayer where we just kind of sit with it. And something that is helpful for me may not be helpful for you is, for me, my fear of failure. I actually picture it as a person. Like I put fear on a person's face in my mind. And I think of walking into the room with fear, and I sit down at a chair, and I look at fear. And I let him talk. I let fear do its thing. And I look at it. I'm sitting with you. I'm not afraid of you and the voice that you have. And so that's where we're going to start. And then as we sit there and as we do that, I'm going to start praying some words of truth about who God is, about who you are, about how who we are. And we're going to see, how does that change the voice of fear? How does that change the face of fear in our lives when it's confronted with the truth that God is bigger and God is with us, okay? Let's go to prayer. God, as we sit here this morning, God, I pray that we would trust you, and God, we would trust your presence with us, God, to sit with our fears, be it the fear of failure, the fear of abandonment, the fear of intimacy, the fear of success, the fear of letting others down, the fear of letting ourselves down, the fear of letting you down, God. And God, I pray that we would see it in all of its ugliness, in all of its distortion. And God, we'd be able to sit with it. Let it yell and say its awful things to us. Because God, as we sit with our fear, we also sit with the God of the universe. And God, you address our fears by being bigger, by being greater. God, you address our fears by telling us how you love us. You address our fears by telling us who you created us to be. Not by telling us what you created us not to do. God, I pray that in the face of our fears, we can know that we are loved, that we belong. God, we have infinite worth. And God, there is a story that fits who we've been created to be that you are inviting us to step out into. But God, we aren't invited to run onto that path away from our fear, but God, we're invited to walk through it, knowing that you are with us, knowing that you empower us, know that you call us. God, I pray that your perfect love would drive out all fear. We would see it wither. We would see it cower, God. We would see it walk away in the face of the truth of who you are and who we are. God, make us brave. It's in your name that we pray. Amen.